these chemical reactions seem to be overly simplistic in terms of how they're portrayed, we are missing a larger dimension. And so now we know there's piezoelectric effects, there's dielectric effects, there's electromotive force dynamics, there's mechanical signaling, there's magnetic signaling, there's all of these other dimensions that help integrate this protein-protein interaction. The physical dimension is the glue, or I should say is the structure that helps guide the biomolecular landscape.
Welcome to the Richie Flow Nutrition Podcast. My name is Cameron Borg. On this episode, I had the pleasure of speaking with Nirosha Murugan. Nirosha is a biophysicist with a particular interest in quantum biology and electrobiology. She is an assistant professor at Wilfrid Laurier University in Waterloo, Ontario, where her lab investigates the biophysical language of cellular communication. Her work has investigated topics including electrical properties of cells, biophotons, heliobiology, magnetobiology, and how all of these aspects of the environment shape the energetic landscape of biological systems. These fields present important areas of investigation, not only in understanding disease, but also understanding life itself. Before we start, this episode is sponsored by no one. I do my very best to keep this podcast free of marketing and bias, so if you would like to support me, I have linked my Substack below. This is where I share further insights into these podcast topics and provide a depth of information not possible here. Any support you can provide is greatly appreciated. With all this being said, I hope you enjoy the episode. Nirosha, thank you so much for giving me some of your time. I've been nervously looking forward to speaking with you. Mostly because there are so many things I think I'd like to ask you, and it's difficult to try and make that concise because I don't understand these topics well. So asking good questions can be difficult, but I think it would be a good place to start by asking you a little bit about your background and also an extension of that, which is what are some of the axioms that you think we're dealing with in science today that you think might be wrong? Because of course, theories can only be as good as the axioms upon which they're built. And it seems like sometimes we actually need to take some axioms down that may have served a purpose at one point, but perhaps are holding us back now. So yeah, maybe that would be a good place to start.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big question that let's unpack that for a minute. So in terms of like my training and background, it's more grounded in neuroscience and biophysics. So I think if we think about the dogmas and the topics within this area, we have this mindset of trying to understand cell communication from a molecular machinery point of view. So we have a pretty good understanding of how cells communicate from a signaling perspective. But what is missing in the assumptions that we're making is that it is all grounded in these molecular dynamics, that they're the ones that are guiding what shape and form is to be determined. We have a really pretty good, robust understanding of the genetic landscape in terms of what arises in terms of shape and pattern. But the missing dimension, as you probably know, and what I'm really focused on is on the physical side, what physical forces help guide those molecular landscapes, especially in terms of what genes get expressed. So we were kind of really looking at it from a bottom-up approach in terms of what guides these expression patterns of signaling molecules, transcription factors, these dynamics. And when we think about neuroscience, kind of the area that I kind of did my training in, we are accepting that there is an interplay on the physics and the molecular side. We are accepting that there's electrical signaling through action potentials and influx of ions. But our understanding there is because there is some physical entity, molecular entity, these ion channel gating, those dynamics is what rises these electrical dynamics. So the assumptions that I want to challenge is that it may not be a bottom-up approach, but a top-down approach in terms of what guides information processing and transmission within a biological system.
Perhaps a good way to continue on with this is, what are some things that you see in the work that you're doing to be really promising directions for science that are probably considered to be, let's say, you know, not real, or, you know, there's a lot of debate around them and people don't accept them, but from your point of view, they are well accepted?
I mean, healthy skepticism is good. Healthy skepticism allows us to frame our questions and use the appropriate tools to help answer those. And so with the understanding that whatever result that we obtain from these well-constructed experimental designs must have some validity to them. But with all things science and all things in terms of beliefs, there is going to be some underlying set of beliefs that we have to overcome. And so if we, through what we have been trained in, is this understanding of molecular language of cells and life. And if that's what we're ingrained in, then any dynamics that we see on the physical side is going to be accepted with some kind of resistance. So the work that we do with optical signaling and trying to look at magnetic stimulation within tissues and cells and how that can control patterning, there's some evidence for it. There's actually quite a lot of evidence for those things, but what seems to be missing is a unifying argument for how that interplays with the molecular landscape, with the biomolecules, with the proteins, the lipids, and the genes. So I think to answer your question in terms of where we see the resistance, and so in terms of what I have encountered, is the disconnect of what is the mechanism. And when we think about mechanism, we think of some sort of protein or genetic grounding, some sort of omic grounding on that end. And I think what we are trying to do with the first paper that we did is try to ground it into something that we do know, but I think there's more opportunity to explore in that area.
So I just want to make sure we're on the same page, and I want to run an idea past you and maybe you can let me know what you think. So a top-down approach sort of uses emergent phenomenon to try and answer questions that are perhaps deeper than they're capable of answering. And one of the things that perhaps bothered me quite a bit when I was learning basic chemistry was you sort of get, you know, the chemical, and then you get an arrow pointing to the next chemical, and it's just assumed that that happens. And I always thought, what does that arrow mean? How does this molecule go to that one? And then, you know, somehow the end result finds its way to the perfect place at the perfect time to encounter the perfect chemical reaction to make the body work. And it never really made sense to me that there was no sort of goal-directedness within the system. Mm-hmm. There was no sort of organizing principle that was allowing the biochemistry to take place in such a coherent fashion. And it sounds to me like what you're interested in is finding out this glue that ties the biochemistry together. You're certainly not saying that the biochemistry doesn't matter, but without a deeper understanding of what is organizing all of that, it's very difficult to move forward in our understanding of sort of defining life. Is that a good way to think about it?
That's a beautifully elegant way of describing exactly what we're trying to do. And you and I have come to the same conclusion almost in the same manner in terms of what has frustrated us into the missing picture of how cells communicate or how biology communicates as a whole. In the sense that, you know, these chemical reactions seem to be overly simplistic in terms of how they're portrayed, we are missing a larger dimension. And so my insights into this also came from thinking about the lock and key model in graduate school. I also was like, how do these one particular proteins find this one receptor? And if you think about the scale of the cell and where these receptors are on the plasma membrane, the probability and time dynamics isn't just as perfect as there's a perfect shape and there's a perfect, you know, place for them to bind together. So thinking about that kind of led me to the idea there must be this other dimension that helps guide this lock and key. So there's no argument that there is a protein-protein interaction that is shape-based, and that's the whole basis of cell communication from in this context. So, but now we know there's piezoelectric effects, there's dielectric effects, there's electromotive force dynamics, there's mechanical signaling, there's magnetic signaling, there's all of these other dimensions that help integrate this protein-protein interaction that I think, you know, from protein chemists or biochemists appreciate this in terms of reaction rates and that it might help them. But from a molecular biologist point of view, when we scale up, we kind of miss and we forget about those dimensions. And so I think to your point and what you're saying and what we both agree on is that the physical dimension is the glue, or I should say is the structure that helps guide the biomolecular landscape. And we're missing and trying to understand what that is. And they can be complementary. Sometimes one can exist without the other, but we need to kind of understand what that interplay is.
I want to dig into some of these physical factors that sort of help to guide what we see at the level of biochemistry and what we're able to observe in a perhaps more conventional manner. I want to start with biophotons, mostly because I had the pleasure of speaking with Roelen van Wijk last week.
Who is
a pioneer of the field, and he taught me a lot, and it was great to just sit down with him and learn a lot. And what I sort of came to understand by him telling me about all of his work with Fritz Popp was that there is this sort of coherent photonic field that exists within us, and our bodies seem to be able to use light in a way where it's communicative. It stores information, and something I've had a bit of trouble wrapping my head around is this idea of information. What does that word precisely mean? And I can think of light providing information in several different ways. Perhaps wavelength would be a way in which you can convey a different message. A red wavelength is different to a blue wavelength. Perhaps amplitude, so the brightness or the photon count could provide information. And then perhaps periodicity, something like a Morse code, sort of, you know, flashing light, you know, sort of phases or oscillations. Do you think that the information that's provided by the light that's inside us, whether that's spontaneous emissions or that's delayed luminescence or whatever it may be, is this the way we think about light conveying information in these types of ways, or is there something deeper?
I think to truly understand and to really answer that question, we kind of need to go back and redefine what you aptly point out is this idea of information.
Mm.
What really is information in terms of what are we measuring? To measure information, we have to understand what it is and what does it mean for cells and tissues.
Yeah.
And so when we think about information from a genetic point of view, like the genetic code, it's highlighted within the sequence of these nucleotide or base pairs, and that's what's being encoded into a protein. So the information in this case is some biomolecule, an arrangement or sequence of something that the receiver is able to understand. And if we kind of break that down into optics, so the various parameters that you've mentioned, those are all able to carry information fundamentally, right? Those are all parameters of light that can be understood by a system. So if we kind of just use that as our basic definition of information, it's some parameter that a system is able to receive that gives it notion of where it came from and what to do with that. I think that is a good way of framing of what we think about information is. So if I put wavelength, a red wavelength at high intensity, low frequency into a biological system, can that biological system understand and do something with that piece of information? Does it carry some sort of history or some sort of bit of arrangement that can be repatterned into something else? So I think thinking about it like that, if you define it like that, then yes, light can carry information and cells can process and understand this information. So I think where a lot of the debate, and actually aptly for some as a field that we need to redefine, is what is the information from an optics point of view that cells and tissue can understand, whatever understand means, or compute or utilize in their signaling of processes.
And I think one of the things we hear about sort of biophotons, even they were called ultra weak emissions, it's implied in the name ultra weak, and that's because what we're able to measure is so small, so faint. But one of the things that I have been thinking about a lot is that's only the photons of light that are escaping. And generally what we want to know is about the light that's being kept within. And these spontaneous emissions, where are they going? Of course, they're surrounded by a milieu of lots of molecules that are capable of absorbing that energy and perhaps doing something, transmuting that energy into something else. And this makes you wonder about what the light is doing on the inside. And clearly it has to be doing something. It has to be being absorbed. I think Stuart Hameroff has done a lot of work with microtubules and the capacity of these microtubules to basically act like fiber optic cables in a sense. So clearly the substrates within the cells and even between the cells, the extracellular matrix is capable of not just absorbing and perhaps using this light as energy, but also ferrying it around the body to maybe take it to places where that light information may be more necessary. And I was interested to find out, you know, you hear a lot that the fingertips are the places where you see the most biophotons typically. And, you know, I was interested to find out that probably all of those, or not all of them, but most of the photons coming out the fingertips did not originate there. They originated elsewhere and they've flown through the body in through some manner and ended up at the fingertips. And so we sort of building this idea of the photon field basically being a superhighway throughout the entire body that's maybe capable of giving coherent information across the whole domain of the body, essentially at the fastest speed possible. Is this a useful, meaningful way to consider what is going on?
Yes. I mean, we're if you think about the biophoton fields, if we're just accepting that light is within the body, within cells and tissues and organ systems, I mean, this field has been growing rapidly in the last, I would say, few years. But as you mentioned, Fritz Albert Popp, and there's lots of other individuals who before came us to even establish that photons are being emitted. So I think that itself is a big understanding that the emission is not what's being utilized within the body. So if it is involved in information processing, only a subset of those photons are going to be, that's being emitted is representative of what's inside being used for information. So to your point, there's a gap here in what we understand of the photons that are being emitted from biology that's used for signaling and information processing, and then what's being emitted. So we need to kind of link those two to see if what is being emitted is related to what's being utilized. So that if those are two different kind of thoughts that need to get established, but if you think about photons being used, the first step is that they need to be propagated. And you alluded to the microtubules as a good candidate from a cellular perspective. And this is something that we're actively working on. So we've shown, as we will probably talk about, is that the brain emits biophotons. We can pick them up outside of the skull. But if it's actually used actively in neural processing, it must traverse across the brain from brain region to brain region. So the work that we're doing right now is looking at aligned nerve fibers, the axons, which are chock-filled with microtubules. And if these systems are able to propagate just light in and of itself, then it'll give us some evidence to say that endogenous light that's created, which is relatively weak than what we will put in, should also be propagated as well. So those are just kind of like a biomaterial property of these axons. Does they have waveguide properties? Are they able to propagate light in and of themselves? And some other features within these axons that's really exciting that a lot of people have talked about or alluded to is this idea of melanin. So pigment proteins that we have, you know, maybe for a reason in the brain, they're high dense neuromelanin is associated with certain regions of the brain. But neuromelanin has a really cool optical feature in terms of the emission and excitation of those pigment proteins. They emit within UV, they are high energy, which we now know within the tryptophan tubulin dimers can also excite and propagate within UV. So there seems to be an overlap in the physical properties of those optical proteins or optical properties of those proteins. So propagation to be determined. I mean, there is distribution of a lot of these proteins throughout the body. So that might give us some evidence to say that these optical signals can get propagated. And then there's the other side of the story is what is being lost? Why is it being lost in terms of the emission that is leaving the body itself? So there's kind of two stories there that need to be understood.
I wonder why ultraviolet would have been the wavelength nature would have evolved to use this type of propagation. Do you have any insights as to why ultraviolet might be an appropriate choice for this type of the propagation of this type of information?
Yeah, so UV is high energy. So the likelihood that it's going to get, and as we know, energy is going to get absorbed and transformed into one state or another, the predominant energy in terms of available energy within the body is usually IR, in the IR leaning side, which is heat, which is going to help catalyze a lot of our molecular reactions. So they can kind of make sense on that domain. The UV photon has been of interest, and a lot of people have looked at this idea of super radiance in terms of the photons coming up with high enough energy to be involved with energy transfer. So within photosynthetic systems, we can see that UV photons have a lot of applicability in there in terms of how much energy is being utilized and propagated within a system. There's implications that the mitochondria, the photons that are coming out from the mitochondria, are actually UV-based. But those need to be validated experimentally, but models have shown that those are UV-based photons.
And that sort of tracks quite well with the fact that mitochondria are filled with these molecules that are UV sensitive, like NAD, which are, you know, changing constantly the ratio of NAD and NADH. And I know that using biophotons, when I first learned about them, I thought for sure where this has to go is diagnostics, because if you can get a readout essentially of what metabolism is doing in real time, you will be able to, in theory, watch a cancerous growth start from the very beginning. And I know, you know, if you look at mammography, for example, which is, you know, early detection in quotes, you know, you can only pick up a mass with that maybe 5 to 10 years after it has already begun. So the benefits of using biophotonics for diagnostics is quite strong. And you have shown, among others, I think this goes back to 2004, showing unique signatures of malignant growth using biophoton measurements. What are the specific sources of light that differentiate malignant cells from, let's say, normal cells?
Yeah, I mean, to that point, and kind of taking a step back, we talked a little bit about the wavelength of light that's associated in terms of where they're emerging. So the cryptochrome C specifically within the mitochondria, is itself blue leaning. So it is receptive to blue light. So that kind of gives us some evidence that blue leaning or UV shifted lights can potentially alter metabolism. And again, this is, there's some people have shown photobiomodulation that there is wavelength specific effect. Usually most of it is on the IR or the near infrared side of things. But if we kind of move towards this idea of using it as a diagnostic, we know that cancer itself, from a metabolic perspective, utilizes a different mechanism than the healthy counterparts. So thinking about the source of these biophotons and what they mean, they're usually coupled to these reactive oxygen species where you have these high intensity, high energy electrons. When they return to ground state, specifically within the mitochondria, they release a photon. So it seems to be an outpour correlated to mitochondrial activity, and kind of linking those two concepts, being cancer having this altered metabolic landscape to their healthy counterparts, and these photons being associated with these metabolic states. What we decided to do is see if they're discriminatory. Can we use biophotons to discriminate between just the healthy and the non-healthy cells? And as you mentioned in the paper, we did. The parameters that are the most important is the frequency of light. So it's not just the intensity, which a lot of people lean on in terms of biophotons. They look at the amplitude. Amplitude is highly dependent on your background photon recording. So there's, you know, black body radiation that's in your environment that is skewed based on the environment that you're in versus I'm in. So looking at intensity is not the best readout of these signals in terms of information. The information is, you can kind of look at it from an entropic point of view, how the emission is kind of being emitted from these cells. Are they emitted randomly? Are they emitted in a rhythmic fashion? And as we know with biology, information and entropy seem to go together, that most of the emissions and the processes that happen in biology are rhythmic. So we can look, and we can kind of look at these emitted signals from an entropic lens. So entropy is a good measure of information. In our paper, we looked at wavelength, wavelength being the intensity or the energy that's being emitted from these, or the energy of the photon that's being emitted from these cells. And when we did that over a 22-hour period, about a 24-hour period, we can see that cancer cells have their own signature of what wavelength is associated with their current state or at that state of that time that healthy cells do not have.
I want to ask you specifically about information and entropy and their relationship. I might need you to explain a little bit more about that, like I'm 5 years old and know nothing about it, just because I really want to get a good grasp on this. I think this goes back to computer science and was it Claude Shannon talking about, you know, So can you unpack that a little bit more for me so I understand the relationship between information and entropy?
Yeah, so entropy in and of itself is a measure of disorder or chaos within the system. Biology likes to have, as we think of it, as some form of order. If we have random signals, so entropy can be looked at as randomness. If the randomness increases, the available information within that signal or system is relatively low because it's completely random. There's no usable piece of information in that signal. As entropy decreases, things become more ordered. You get structure. So speech, auditory signals, brain signals, there seems to be some order, right? So if you had a sine wave that's a perfectly ordered structure, there would be relatively low entropy within that signal. So we can kind of look at meaningful information of what information can be used by biology by looking how ordered or how less random it is. If biophotons are just random offshoots of metabolism, they would be highly entropic and they wouldn't have much information. So the way that we utilize entropy and information is just by randomness and ordered and disordered. So the more disordered that signal is, the less likely that it's going to have meaning for the biology to utilize that signal.
That makes sense. I guess something I want to get your perspective on is, do you think disease, perhaps cancer included, do you think all disease is in essence compensatory, meaning do you think that some disease is just the body not knowing what to do or making a mistake, or do you think that it always knows what it's doing, it's always doing its best to compensate for whatever is going on?
That's an excellent question. I like that. I think this is where the reframing of how we think about biology can happen. So if we think of it as if we think of biology as a system that is just responding to applied signals, we don't have a lot of input to this idea of agency. Does biology have agency? And I feel like that's a whole other conversation. But if we look at the system and biology as a energetic landscape, there are set points for certain organs and systems to be at energetically, that any deviation from that energetic set point, the biology is going to try to take over to move it back. And that's what we call homeostasis, right? Some level where the biology is happy at being at. And that, to include physics into this and to include molecular signaling, if we think about it as an energetic landscape, that there's an optimal amount that deviations from this, and this might become we're sick or the arising of cancer, or cancer itself is an energetic system, but it's different from our healthy states. So if we view this mispatterning of energy, which is an interesting concept there, the biology will try to reestablish its system to compensate for this energetic dysfunction or energetic misalignment, we can call it. I don't know if that answers your question, but I think this is an area that I'm now starting to think about that can help incorporate photonics and magnetic signaling and electrical signaling to help understand what patterning is and what mispatterning is throughout the body.
Yeah, it's something I've been thinking about for a very long time, and I've never been able to make any progress on the idea because it seems so complex. But I found Mike Levin's conversations to be quite helpful in this area, particularly when it comes to agency. And it's a difficult point to get to, but maybe we won't go into too much detail about the energy resistance principle, but maybe now would be a good time to touch on it, which is this idea that hopefully the paper will come out soon with yourself and Martin Picard. about this idea that resistance in the system is very important. And one of the things I wanted to ask you is, how do we conceptualize resistance and the role that it's playing in energy flow?
If we had free-flowing energy, we would have combustion. We would have unrestricted amount of energy within the body. The taking that energy and slowing it down enough so that it becomes structured in what we call chemical bonds is where we get patterns, right? So the energy that's going to exist within chemical bonds or kinetic energy and fluid dynamics, magnetic, optic, those are all the same kinds of energy that are now structured in different forms, right? Kind of goes back to the first laws of thermodynamics. Where the resistance comes in, and which is what we argue is one of the most important concepts in terms of trying to understand life in and of itself, that energy needs to be slowed down or needs to be reframed into some other modality so it can get utilized. And so we see this in plants do this very well. They harvest the energy from the sun and they slow it down, they move it, they compartmentalize it within these bonds of chemicals. We break those bonds, that energy gets transformed into what we do as in our day-to-day cellular life. So the resistance, which is the pushback into energy flow, is what we are arguing is involved with the patterning of life. And alterations in those set points for those energy resistant states is what we think could be a reframing of the arising of disease states.
Where did you come up with the equation energy resistance equals energy potential over flow squared?
So this is, again, we probably should have this conversation with Martin Picard, but this is a more of a Martin inspiration, but it eloquently describes potential, like the potential for that energy to get transformed is met by some barrier of flow. So how much flow is going to get moved from one position to the other, from distance A to distance B, is altered by the potential for it to actually get moved. That potential is your resistance. But I think this should be saved for a later conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I've seen sort of a very elegant model of showing something like this, which is these electronic self-organizing, I think they're called eSophy trees, where you have like these little metal beads in a petri dish and you run like a current through it and they will self-organize into these beautiful little patterns. And they never self-organize into the same pattern. They're always finding different ways of letting that current run through. And I think it's just a great sort of very simple representation of how not just biological systems, but complex systems in general are capable of using this resistance to generate structure. And the fact that even if you run the same current through over and over, you get slightly different structures, makes me think of, is it William James's notion of what intelligence is, which is the ability to get to the same place through different means or in different ways. And, you know, it really comes back to this idea of life starting or life sort of being this way of shuttling energy or shaping energy as it flows, which I think is probably maybe the best way we can conceptualize of what life, what biology is just something that's capable of shaping the flow of energy in such a way.
That's a beautiful way of putting it, because if we think, you know, from the beginning of the universe, the energy is a thing that gets propagated. It's the concept that creates life and sustains life. But now I think when we think about biology, the resistance to guide that flow and to move it into something meaningful, we must think of like the material properties. So in those little balls that you're talking about that is able to conduct electricity, that slight variation in what can get conducted and the path that it takes is intrinsic to the property of that bead. You know, it's slightly less round or some has immaterial some sort of contaminant in it that slightly makes it less electric. So there's some thoughts here in how we think about biology. So if we think about energy flow and energy resistance, there's always going to be some level of flow that of energy that's always created and always propagated. But the material properties, the intrinsic properties of the biology is what's going to help with that resistance and determine why the energy resistance of a mitochondria is different from, let's say, the Golgi apparatus in terms of the actual raw material property of how much and how the energy flows. So I think this is where that reframing of what is information. So there's like an integrative process here. What is information? How is that propagated in biology? What do, like, our conventional sense right now is cell to cell signaling in terms of biomolecules. So that's one level. How do we integrate this idea of energy within the system and how do we propagate it? And that's kind of looking at like the biomaterial side of things that could give us one aspect of it from a very small perspective. And then emergent properties from this, what arises that from these small scale things interacting with each other.
Before we move on, I want to ask you about biomaterials. You mentioned melanin before. I know melanin has peculiar properties. It seems to be highly conserved. We don't just have one type of melanin. There are several different types of melanin. You mentioned neuromelanin before, which is, you know, if you've ever seen, you know, a picture of a brain cut in half and the substantia nigra is there, it's just black in the middle of the brain. And you think, why could that possibly be in there? What is melanin, you know, to you? When you think about melanin, what is it doing inside the body? It seems like highly mobile. It's not just on the skin. I was interested to learn when you go out and tan, the tan that comes up is not new melanin that's been made. It's usually melanin that's come from further down to the very top. And then much later, you make new melanin. So clearly, it's a highly mobile substance with a lot of particular, with a lot of unique properties. When you think of melanin's role in the body, what do you think about?
I think about light. I think about the intrinsic property of when we think about melanin, and we just say the word, we think about skin and, you know, it being a protective barrier, first line of defense to the sun. But internally, as you mentioned, it also could be what I think, and some people have actually shown this from injury studies, is that when tissue gets injured, it releases reactive oxygen species, which we now know is coupled to light. This actually gets sequestered and picked up by melanin. So it's a signaling molecule in this case to recruit the immune cells to help repair the tissue. So to me, melanin is a light absorber and a light guidance compound. So this is quite interesting in where we're thinking about even propagation of light. The distribution of melanin can be potentially a signal generator in terms of how much light that's being propagated within an organ or an organelle. The distribution is also quite interesting, and that's kind of like where I'm thinking this can be involved in. You alluded to different kinds of melanin. So we have the eumelanin, which is what we think of as the dark states, but we also have pheomelanin, which is red-leaning. So the fact that there's which absorbs a different wavelength of light.
Yeah.
So this is also found internally in different structures. So this kind of gives us more and more evidence that the internal light that's being generated by biochemistry, perhaps, we're not really confident about that, is associated and is involved, it's important to be incorporated in the signaling cascade.
Interesting. And I've heard talk, I can't say I've read anything directly about this, but melanin seems to be a semiconductor and you know, among other parts of biology that have semiconductive properties. Is there, in your mind, what is the relevance of semiconductive properties, maybe perhaps not just in melanin, but in biological compounds in general?
Well, that's it to me, as I look at it, is another way of energy flow.
Yeah.
So it's another modality that we look at of how energy can get transported. So this is kind of going back to the full circle of communication. If communication were to be altered from a biomolecular point of view, that energy still needs to flow somewhere. So having the innate properties of biomaterials being conductive or semiconductive or so forth will still propagate that energy within the body. So it's still, to me, it's another form of helping with the information conductance within the body.
We've spoken quite a bit about energy, and I want to touch on this idea that perhaps ATP is not the energy currency that we once thought it was. I know there have been several people who have challenged this idea that ATP, the high energy phosphate bond, is where the majority of the energy of the cell comes from. What do you think about this? I've always found it quite difficult to believe that ATP is always present at the exact moment in the exact proportions required for the cell, and perhaps it's involved, but maybe not directly. How do you see this issue, do you see it as an issue with this ATP story?
I don't see it as an issue per se. I see it as being an incomplete story. So ATP is a very high energy source, and it's readily available in high enough abundance. So the dimension that's missing here is also time and spatial distribution of where that energy is. It's localized within the mitochondria. It's a good source. It's there. I think photons, in terms of what is being absorbed from the external environment and what's being generated, you don't have this light generation, or what we think is majority of that generation is coupled to ROS. So, which is the one byproduct of this ROS signaling is ATP. So, but light is pretty fast as we know it. So for it being transformed, a lot of people have shown and suggested that the light that's generated is reabsorbed back into the water environment that of the mitochondria. So there could be other sources of energy, but again, thinking about the biomaterial and the landscape, the photons do get absorbed. We're not sure if they're involved with propagation. So the ATP dimension is a readily available source for energy to be used.
Okay. And, you know, we eat food ultimately to get protons and electrons mm-hmm. that are capable of generating ATP, turning the ATPase. I've been thinking quite a bit about potentially other sources of electrons in the body other than the ones we get from food. And in a few of the papers that you've been involved in, Jerry Pollack's work has been referenced, and this notion of the charge separation of water potentially liberating mm-hmm. Quite a bit of negative charge, which, you know, having spoken to him a few times, seems like he thinks that it's possible that these could be providing quite a lot of energy for the cell, because the charge separation ultimately makes a battery. What do you think is the relevance of Pollack's work, but also the other work in the water field that looks at all of these intriguing properties of water, extending out to, you know, what Jacques Benveniste and Emilio mm-hmm. de Guidice have shown with these coherent domains in water, this idea that water is not just bulk, it's not, you know, just completely random, but there are these large spaces of water that is highly ordered and capable of perhaps even storing mm-hmm. energy. How does this water story sort of connect?
Water is a solvent of life as we know it, and the interfacial water properties are quite interesting. They do have the ability to carry a charge in and of itself. So at the boundary conditions around the plasma membrane, we think of it, the plasma membrane has its charge separation, but at the boundary condition, there is also unique electrical properties, dielectric properties that Pollack and others have hypothesized that could help with protein guidance and protein folding and things. Another interesting feature there is that with these changes in electrical properties, you're going to have changes in electromagnetic changes in field generation. So to answer your question, I don't think I know or we know as a field enough about the interactions between interfacial water and biophotons. But we do know that on the magnetic field side that they're able to hold magnetic fields for much longer than typical and change that distribution of positive charges leading to more alteration in pH. And, you know, that's typically how people think of it affecting chemistry. But I would like to think of it as changing the electromagnetic field domains within those structured water area to allow for more electromagnetic interactions between proteins and other biomolecules.
That's fascinating. So it's really, or it seems like you're suggesting that the storage capacity of these electromagnetic fields within the water is an important aspect of allowing the cell to undertake its daily jobs, basically, and being able to do that in a coherent fashion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And looking at the mitochondria as highly receptive to these changes in electric, and we now know they're in photonic fields as well, perhaps their function and alignment is also guided by the structured water around them. There are high energy sources in those areas, from protons to electrons, and also electromagnetic fields. And the Picard lab has also shown that the mitochondria can align. So, but the source of those alignments is yet to be determined. And I have a strong hypothesis that it could be that it's this interfacial water. Some properties in terms of the electromagnetic dynamics of that environment perhaps could align that mitochondria. And if that was the case, do then the mitochondria act as these information processing units that move that information with and around the cell?
When you say the mitochondria align, are you talking specifically about their cristae? Because I've seen some of Picard's papers where they have little videos watching the cristae all come together, even though there's no physical junction. But Correct. It seems like there's some sort of field, or there's something invisible that you can't see through the video that's aligning these cristae. And you think that's it has correct. Something to do with the water?
I think that is a good first hypothesis to test, as the interfacial water itself has these high energy and structured entities and can hold these electromagnetic fields. The mitochondria are also receptive to applied magnetic fields. So that needs to be explored much further.
I agree quite a bit. And I want to ask you about these magnetic fields, particularly as they pertain to the Earth's static magnetic field, because we see a gradient, essentially, not perfectly, but essentially from the equator to the poles. There is a gradient where it's the magnetic field is lower at the equator and generally higher at the poles. And there are other things that play into that. It's not a perfect correlation, but it makes me wonder if we have several aspects of these important parts of the energy story we've been talking about that are receptive to magnetic fields. Are there differences depending on where you are on the Earth about how those things react? And I know Pollack has shown, that this type of exclusion zone water will nucleate at the poles of permanent magnets. And it seems to me as though, if you're up in Svalbard, your water is going to be intrinsically different than if you are in Costa Rica, for instance, because the magnetic field that you're exposed to is different, slightly so, but it seems like our body's pretty good at picking up on very slight differences. So, am I crazy for thinking that perhaps even these small changes in the Earth's weak magnetic field could be playing sort of permanent roles in how the water is behaving, and then all of the other things that follow on from that?
That's an excellent question. In terms of the local static magnetic fields and how it can affect water, we know that static magnetic fields can, but a lot of those changes have to do with high intensity magnetic field changes, with the geomagnetic field being very, very low, high nanotesla to low microtesla ranges. Seeing those differences in those two regions, as you mentioned, it could happen, we'd need to measure. I think what's, as you alluded to, very important is that the geomagnetic field is extremely important at regulating life and patterning life. We've seen this, we've shown this ourselves in my lab and other people. Clarice D'Aiello has also shown this, that by reducing the local geomagnetic field and hypomagnetic chambers and looking at early development in tadpoles, frog tadpoles, for example, you get all sorts of alterations in structure that's formed. Just keeping in mind that, hypoxic conditions, oxygen conditions, and nutrient conditions are kept consistent, and the only thing changing is the geomagnetic field, we see all sorts of phenotypes that arise that are abnormal compared to the wild types. So this kind of gives us some insight that these magnetic fields are guiding in patterning in some force. And these are just local geomagnetic fields. So if it's guiding at an early embryonic stages, it could be guiding the structured water. It could be guiding metabolic activity, ion channel dynamics across the plasma membrane, all of which are the physical side of the signaling landscape rather than just the molecular.
Interesting. I've seen and I've been quite interested in some of the work from Wendy Bean's lab looking at the influence of these magnetic fields on the behavior of free radicals. And it seems to be quite pertinent, the magnetic field strength on how superoxide behaves, for instance. And it makes me wonder if it's having an effect on the radicals, then it's obviously having an effect on the biophotonics as well. And clearly all of these things are tied in together. And it makes me wonder, I don't know the answer to this, perhaps you do, but if you're living, you know, I'm on the ground floor here, but if I'm living in a high-rise building and I'm, you know, 10 stories off the ground, is the magnetic field going to be significantly weaker that far above the ground than it would be if I was on the ground level? And if so, is this going to shape the behavior of the reactive oxygen species inside me and thus the light show that's going on? And could that have biological effects?
Likely not in terms of that kind of altitude differences. But, you know, much higher than that and, you know, the ranges in which flights usually take off, there's absolutely going to be changes in geomagnetic fields. There are magnetometers that are placed across the world that's looking at these local geomagnetic changes. They're very low. They're very small, subtle changes. Where we see the biggest effect is when we have these solar storms where plasma gets emitted from our sun due to high activity, and when they're directed towards the Earth, it perturbs our geomagnetic shield, then changing our local geomagnetic patterns that way. So there's on the heliobiology side of things, there's some really interesting effects that really kind of gives us an opportunity to ask the question is, what is then the role of geomagnetic fields? And are we able to, if there is a role, what is the sensing mechanism? What is the interactive mechanism that kind of asks and answers these questions? So there's a lot to unpack on that area.
I guess that leads me to asking about anthropogenic electromagnetic radiation and the fact that I've probably never spent a day in my entire life devoid of that radiation, and it's quite a polarizing topic. And I think it's quite clear that there are biological effects, and unpacking the extent of those is quite difficult for a number of reasons. Perhaps you could maybe let me know about your thoughts about where we're at with regard to exposure to the ever-increasing amount of electromagnetic fields from all the gadgets, from all the cell towers and so forth, because the epidemiology does seem to show a relationship between these things, and it seems as though it's not something to be ignored, maybe even just from the aspect of reproductive health as well. So what is your stance on you know, the use of these types of devices and proximity to things like high voltage power lines?
As you say, there is a lot of evidence to support that these magnetic fields, high intensity magnetic fields and high frequency magnetic fields, absolutely affects human biology. One important distinction that I want to make, and kind of to maybe to alleviate some worry, is that much like with the patterns of chemicals and the rhythms that exist in our human behavior, the pattern of magnetic field we now see is extremely important to the interaction with biology. So if we take out the various parameters within EMFs, you have the intensity, you have the frequency, we have whether it's an alternating or direct current generating magnetic field. And then now we're also looking at pattern. We know that if we kind of scale from high voltage power lines all the way down to, you know, very weak geomagnetic fields, there's a huge range of intensity there. And why these high energy fields seem to play a role is because they're exactly that. They're high energy. You're putting a lot of energy within the system. And if we, as we mentioned, if we reframe our thinking as our body as an energetic system, if you put in a lot of energy, it needs to get transformed and utilized in some way, which is probably going to induce some form of pathology. But if we pattern that field to at a low enough intensity to match something like neural firing, then those intensities of magnetic field become important. And that's where transcranial magnetic stimulation comes in, where we can use it to help rewire the brain against pathology. So I think there's potentially some clarification that needs to happen here to help alleviate some worries, that there needs to be some insight into intensities of fields that you're concerned about, the pattern that is being utilized, and the frequency domain, which is related to the energy and the intensity. If all of those are very high and there's not enough information in that system, then of course it's going to induce damage. But if you can weaken that, pattern it in a biomimetic way, where we can kind of match it to the patterns of firing within the brain, for example, or the heart, then we can use it for a therapeutic potential.
I absolutely agree that anything that can cause pathology could probably also be used therapeutically. And one of the things that's been sort of stuck in my mind about this is this idea of non-linearity and not necessarily having the higher exposure energy, but perhaps a lower exposure at a specific orientation or for a specific individual could yield much worse effects or could yield effects compared to no effects, even at a higher intensity. This idea that perhaps even very small fields could yield disproportionately large effects in some individuals. And for whatever reason, we don't know, maybe, you know, the someone's height or, you know, a specific SNP that makes a specific protein a slightly different shape and that it resonates in some way, shape or form. And what we see is this complete heterogeneity across a population and impossible to pick it out with the epidemiology. And that is a concern that I've been thinking about, is what happens if the effects are completely nonlinear and they're completely heterogeneous and some people are suffering really, really poorly with something like electromagnetic hypersensitivity, where under the exact same conditions, other people feel absolutely nothing and they don't get pathology. And it's been... I don't know how we would go about unpacking that on a population level.
Well, I think to your point, how these experiments are done and what variables are being utilized in and integrated into the analysis is important. You can have two people with the same different exposure system, but don't forget about their environment. Yeah. Where there is generation of magnetic fields. And I think also, and this is where like things have started to develop a lot for me, and what we're focusing on in the lab is that every individual and every cell and tissue and organ in the body is going to have this energy resistance landscape. It's going to have a set threshold that it's going to be functioning at. And if we can imagine that person A will be at a certain energy resistance value versus person B or their system, applying the same input can shift that threshold in a positive or negative direction. So I think that has now illuminated a whole domain of how these magnetic fields can interact. I think in the past we were looking for a receptor that, you know, a magnetoreceptor that can interact with the signaling as an input. But I think we should be looking at the cell and the environment as a complete energetic landscape. How much energy is in that system and how can it interact with what energy is coming in and out physically? And no two people are not or going to be in that state. And no two incidences of a same person, you know, you or I today or the end of the day, energetically, we're going to be different. So applying a magnetic field and these two different states within the same person could produce a different effect. And we see this, and I think that's why the applied magnetic field literature is so inconsistent with these results. You know, there's so many people throughout decades that have applied magnetic fields for cancer studies as anti-cancer therapies, and you'll have a subset of people that will show an anti-cancer effect, and then you'll have a subset of people that show a pro-cancer effect.
Yeah.
And what we're doing in the lab is actually showing and validating that the local environment in which you do these experiments are different. And that can predict whether the outcome is going to be pro or anti-cancerous treatments or not. And that, again, it kind of goes back into looking at things as an energetic system and an open system that's able to interact with its environment energetically that can produce an output.
So the energetic landscape is precisely what's going to determine whether an input is net positive or net negative.
That's correct, yes.
Yeah, right, okay. I want to ask you about ion cyclotron resonance, and I'd like you to maybe explain it to me again, maybe like I'm 5 years old. That would be very helpful. I want to get an understanding of this and where it might be relevant in biological systems.
So the ion cyclotron resonance is basically the movement of ions in the presence of a magnetic field.
Yeah.
So you can guide the flow of ions, if you think of it biologically, in or out of the between the plasma membrane in the presence of a magnetic field. That's the basic concept of it. And that seems to be how people think these applied magnetic fields work, especially in the static magnetic fields, that they're high enough intensity to help force move these applied force to help move these ions within and out of the cell.
When they resonate in a specific way, they can resonate with specific ions and cause them to have the effect.
Correct.
Right.
Correct. That's intensity and frequency based.
That's really fascinating. I noted in one of your papers, you talk about being able to essentially show the effect that calcium would have just by using the resonance rather than having the actual ions there, which was very interesting to me. And one of these sort of quantum properties that life seems to use in order to make things coherent and ordered, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the idea of what we're really trying to focus on is pattern. And to give more evidence to the idea that biology interacts with internal patterns that it generates, but it can, if we can match it to what we apply from an applied signal perspective, then potentially biology can interact with that information as well. So we created a magnetic field pattern that mimicked T-type calcium channels. And as we know, there's various protein ion channel types and subtypes. And the idea here was to show specificity in the applied signal to the actual protein dynamics themselves.
That's extremely fascinating. That sort of ties in this idea of pattern and coherence, sort of ties into this idea of a Frohlich condensate state that I've read about quite a bit, but never really been able to develop a deep understanding of. Would you be able to maybe help me understand this concept of a Frohlich condensate state and how it might be relevant inside the human body?
That's something that I'm going to need a little bit of time to work into, but it basically works off of the idea that the chemical kinetics of a system is regulated by the available energy within the system. But that's not something that I feel comfortable digging into.
Okay, you and me both then. Okay. yes, all right. Where to go from here? There were so many things I wanted to ask you. Yes. In one of your papers that I was reading, perhaps bravely you mentioned the idea of earthing. Typically, this is maybe seen as taboo in science to be talking about this. I know there's perhaps not as much science out there as we would like, but there does seem to be an effect. Something's going on here when we come in contact with the Earth's electric field. Do you have any additional insights into what might be going on when we place our bare feet on the ground outside?
I'm not sure I discussed the electrical field, but I did discuss the geomagnetic field.
Okay.
From what we see from our experiments, the perturbations in the geomagnetic fields, and many people have actually written books on this to show that social behavior and individual personality and behavior alters in high intense geomagnetic storms. beyond just satellites and antennas dysfunctioning, that there seems to be this alteration in human behavior. So in terms of like where my perspective and my understanding of this is that if we are energetic systems, then our environmental fields can interact with us. And there are a subset of people who are sensitive or hypersensitive to these changes. Just like how there's some people who are sensitive to the weather or barometric pressures, there seems to be people who are sensitive to these changes in these local or environmental geomagnetic fields as well. So that's kind of where the interest has gone. We use those signals and large perturbations to alter cell physiology. And kind of that's where we're kind of focused on. But other people have shown them.
It seems like our bodies have a biofield, and that word sort of frustrates me because I think it's got a lot of woo-woo attached to it. But yes, we do have fields. These are what are measured with, EEGs and so forth. And it makes me wonder about proximity to other people and, mm-hmm. Sharing physical touch and the continuous flow of information coming out about how important human connection is, not only social connection, but also things like touch and how important they are to longevity. And it seems to be an independent, way of increasing longevity is just by having social connection and having touch. And there are people out there who appear to have some sort of healing touch, or they're healers. They can put their hands over. I think they use guinea pigs in some of these studies, and they show quite remarkable results sometimes. And I would think this would be something that the average scientist would say, "Well, that's complete rubbish." Yet it's something perhaps we need to take seriously if we're looking at the fact that the body has all of these fields that are sort of combining to make the biofield of one's body. How do you think these biofields are interacting with each other and perhaps even interacting with nature as well? There seems to be something real here.
Absolutely. I think the one dimension that we need to spend some time investigating is the sensing ability. How do we sense these fields? So if they are being emitted, what is the purpose? Like, biology doesn't do a lot of things inefficiently. There needs to be some sort of purpose, or else it'll kind of get evolved over time. So if I do think, when you have electric current, you have electricity, you will have magnetism. And so we see that with now squid technology, we can pick up the magnetic field off of the head, and we can use those same technology to look at the cardiac field. So we are accepting that the brain and the heart are emitting magnetic fields, and we can pick them up. We can interact them by putting magnetic field in. And as Mike Levin shown, the body is electric. We have every cell in our body that generates or has a electric field around it. So it must then also have a magnetic field just by the laws of physics. So we don't understand that just only because we can't measure it. The field intensities are very weak in the order of femtotesla to picotesla ranges. So our technology is catching up such that we can pick up those fields now and use them for biological applications. But there is something to be said to these nonverbal communication that you and I and all these species, like, we know that birds, for example, they use magnetoreception for migration, and they have a special protein called cryptochrome, but we have those same proteins within our mitochondria as well. So there's a lot of these overlap that we're seeing within nature that we are okay and sort of more receptive to the idea that a plant can interact with magnetic environments. But when we think about the human body, there's a lot more resistance into that cognitive acceptance of this area. But again, to your point, there are evidence where some people seem to interact better with their enhancing or engaging with their own inner fields. But this requires us to really explore that domain a little bit better.
Yeah, I know people like Rupert Sheldrake and Dean Radin have done, quite interesting work showing that we have these sort of innate capacities. Maybe they've been dampened quite a bit by modern living and being told the fact that they don't exist. But I think even hunters know not to look at the deer they're about to shoot because the deer can mm-hmm. sense it. It seems like there is some sort of innate capacity for these types of mm-hmm.
And we see that with horses, for example. Horses are these animals seem to know, whatever that means, that there's something in their environment. So that knowing, and there's actually some human studies that were published where they had participants in a room where they, in a controlled manner, they applied an external field or not, and were asked to press a button when they felt that they were being exposed to a field. And remarkably, they were pretty accurate. So there is some sort of innate sensing ability that we are able to sense changes in our magnetic field, whether there's a magnetic field there or not. It's just trying to understand, how do we then translate that into our perceptive experience? How is those neural networks then processing that information?
And you mentioned before, but one of the most well-known sort of ways is the radical pair mechanism that was hypothesized for, I think it was, European robins. And I think that's quite well accepted now, although I don't think this has been shown in humans. Do we have, first of all, how is it looking, this radical pair mechanism, as far as it being possible in humans? And are there other similar sort of quantum biological mechanisms with mm-hmm. which we can pick up on these things?
I think the radical pair mechanism is our strongest working theory on how applied magnetic fields and these quantum processes can interact with biology. There seems to be a rate limiting step in terms of converting that into the molecular language. There are scientists that have explored this idea in terms of energetics, but I'm not aware of that, as you mentioned, of them being used in cell and molecular biology, but that needs to be explored. And I think one area that is pretty, I think, ripe to be explored is within neural dynamics, especially within mitochondrial activity. So the radical pair mechanism, just to kind of quickly go over, is changing the spin dynamics over the electrons. So when you, whether they're in a triplet or in a doublet state, you are going to get different products depending on which state they're in. So if we apply a magnetic field and it puts them into one state, you'll get one product. Changing that field or reducing that field, you get another product. So the mitochondria seems to be the most obvious sensor for these in terms of the molecular and biochemical reactions that happen, but I'm not aware of any experiments that have been done to validate that yet, which would be very exciting to do.
Yeah, I agree, absolutely. And one of the, just to switch gears a little bit, but you, I believe it's still in preprint, you were co-author on a paper about circadian rhythms and mm-hmm. biological rhythms in general, and the mm-hmm. ways in which they are kept in sync with the earth and certain things that can perturb them. And there is mm-hmm. a laundry list of things that all go into playing a role in curating biological rhythm. I think the one we're most familiar with is the rising and setting of the sun. But the geomagnetic field of the earth also shifts from morning to night as well. Very slightly, we seem to be able to pick up on those small changes as well. And we know that disturbed circadian rhythm is a risk factor for, you name it, it's everything. It's sort of when we're evolving, all of these exposures that we get from the environment were expected. You know, they were just mm-hmm. standard. We could not deviate from them in nature. But now it's almost as if every single aspect of our environment is doing something to throw off the body's ability to maintain its synchronicity with the earth. What do you think, what role do you think this circadian disruption is playing in what we see as the modern disease epidemics today? How large is this problem?
I think it's pretty disruptive to a given person. There are cohorts of people who have employment that have these disruptive shift working, for example. We can see, and there's lots of epidemiological studies that have shown that short-term and even chronic shift working can lower lifespan. So it is it's a big driver, sleep-wake cycles and alteration sleep-wake cycles, altering memory capacity, plasticity, learning. I think it is, there's tons of evidence to illustrate that alterations in circadian rhythms is fundamental to generating pathology. And it kind of trickles down to metabolism, feeding behaviors, social behaviors, hormonal cyclations. All of that is all guided by your hypothalamus and the circadian sleep wake cycle. So I think it is fundamental.
We see structure being intimately related to function. It's something you cannot get away from. And one of the big problems that's faced perhaps after the Human Genome Project was this idea that you could not explain form based on genes. And this has led some, like Rupert Sheldrake, to hypothesize the presence of another field we cannot measure yet, a morphogenetic field, that is responsible for this morphing, this coming into form. And like I said, we can't measure it, so it remains a hypothesis. And I've seen papers that look at basically taking the mitochondria's ability mitochondria's ability to repair itself away through knockout experiments and so forth. And one of the characteristics of these mice is that they get severe kyphosis. They get huge humpbacks. They're structurally quite deformed. And that's because of their energy, the energy landscape, as you say, has been completely decimated. Mm-hmm. And what you see is an ultimate resulting in poor structure as well. You can't unentangle the two. And I guess that sort of leads me to the idea that the energy landscape is what's defining the form. Do you think this is a good way to try and understand how certain organisms have their specific forms? It's because the energy landscape is such that
that's
allows
exactly
that form.
That's the thinking that I have reframed the interactions with magnetic fields in light, is that to explain this heterogeneity, and you know, there are going to be changes in expression values of ion channels. So there's going to be heterogeneity on the biomolecular landscape that doesn't explain what and how the structure can translate into the function, especially in time dynamics. To have structural changes that happen relatively quickly, those gene expression profile and, you know, protein expression profile time dynamics don't seem to line up. So reframing this from an energetic point of view makes sense, and kind of tying back to alterations or dysfunctions in the mitochondria to structural deformity kind of lends to the idea of the energetic resistance principle that we kind of alluded to, that if there are certain thresholds of resistance within the body of how energy can flow, and you've now added more barrier to that, that energy must flow somewhere.
Yep.
So the flow, though in that one direction, the flow capacity has altered, perhaps another system, it has to move, and the potential for that energy to move will now change to reform structure elsewhere. Which is what we're now thinking, and Martin and I are working on a paper on this, is viewing cancer as a rising from a dysfunction in energy resistance within the body. Are there locations within the body for whatever, you know, genetic accumulation, whatever that might cause the resistance, are they accumulating such barriers such that that energy flow and capacity needs to get altered into some other domain which might arise that cancer? So this is a working thought.
That's really fascinating. I can't wait to read that paper when it comes to fruition. I don't normally ask this, but I'd love to know, are there any specific things you do in your life to make sure you stay healthy for as long as possible?
This idea of energy landscape view has trickled into my life as well. I have always intermittent fasted throughout my life. And now I have a new appreciation for how energy is computed and is articulated within my body. So regularly I will intermittent fast to help realign the resistance flows within my body and how energy is processed efficiently. And I think that one domain that we often think about, which I've tried to incorporate in my life, is the efficiency of my energy. and appreciating sleep, and, you know, prioritizing sleep, not just because I need it to help, you know, remove waste, but that waste is a form to alter energy flow for when I do wake up and can be my best self. So I think the normal behaviors that we kind of take granted for have been reevaluated from this lens of energy resistance and energy flow to help prioritize these things within my life.
So what are you working on now? What's the next year or so looking like for you? What are you prioritizing and what are you hoping to uncover, I suppose?
Yeah, I'm very excited for the next year. We have quite a few projects in the pipeline. Our lab really focuses, we use the biophysics in terms of applied fields and signaling in various contexts in regenerative medicine. So looking at stem cell physiology, cancer, to reprogram them and trying to understand even like communication in neural systems. So I kind of alluded to one of the projects that we're working on is looking at optical fiber alignment and photon propagation. So we're taking biological tissue, we're taking aligned microtubules in a dish or spinal cords that already have aligned microtubules in them and looking at whether they can propagate light. If they can propagate light, then that gives us evidence that that photonic information is information and it can get moved from point A to point B. Some other projects that we're trying to understand is applying magnetic fields. So we talked about the heterogeneity in results that we see across various domains. What I'm trying to do now is ground the applied magnetic field effects in mitochondrial or energy resistance. How does it alter the energy landscape within cells and tissues? And can we control that with magnetic fields to reprogram cancer? If they are using this altered energy mechanism, can we use that to reprogram them? And then the last sets of projects that we're working at is the patterning of these magnetic fields. If we pattern them, can we interact with biology in a more meaningful way to enhance the response that we get? So what we're trying to do is looking at the biomimetic enhancement of TMS. So transcranial magnetic stimulation is well used right now in for various mental health disorders and dysfunctions. They don't have this overlay of biomimicry. They don't have pattern associated with it. And what we're trying to do is see if we can enhance the effect in neuroplasticity by matching burst firing patterns within the brain.
Fascinating. I want to be cautious of your time. I'll finish with a sentiment of yours, actually. You said, if we want biology to evolve, we need more physicists in the room and more biologists speaking their language.
Yes, absolutely.
I think that's a really brilliant way to start to try and move forward with what we're doing. And hopefully there are plenty of young people listening to this who are looking for a career in science and realizing that you know, there are things beyond probably what they'll see in their textbook that will be relevant to understanding what life is, a fundamental question for humans. So I can't thank you enough for your time. It's been something I've been looking forward to for a while. So I really appreciate it and appreciate the work you're doing.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Cameron. I'm really excited about this. And as you mentioned, I think reframing our mindset of not just of how we view biology, but how we learn about biology. So as the next generation, as they inquire into this space, integrating various dimensions will be very fruitful for the future.
I couldn't agree more. Thank you. Thank you so much for listening. I really hope you enjoyed our conversation. I've left links to some of Nirosha's work below if you'd like to read some of her publications. I've also left all of my links in the episode notes. Please feel free to subscribe and engage. There will be much more content like this to come. Again, if you'd like to support my work, please consider subscribing to my Substack, as this is where I share most of my thoughts and insights that go beyond the scope of the podcast. It really helps me keep all of this going. Thanks again for listening, everyone. Take care.